It is Monday, July the 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, what happens to the Islamic State now that they're virtually routed out of Mosul?
I think in various places, ungoverned territories, they will find a home. Somalia, the Sinai, they have an alliance with Boko Haram in West Africa.
Also ahead, U.S.-Russia brokered ceasefire in Syria.
It's relatively easy to agree on de-escalation in parts of Syria that do not have to do with the Islamic State. That's something that both the United States and Russia are keen to do.
Tensions in Venezuela, plus remembering a near-perfect vocalist. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi went to Mosul to congratulate the armed forces for their victory over the Islamic State after nearly 9 months of urban warfare, virtually bringing to an end jihadist rule in the city. VOA's Victor Beatty asked James Jeffrey, a former senior American diplomat and an expert in political and security issues in the Middle East at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, if Abadi's visit was premature.
No. What we would call in military terms organized resistance was destroyed over the weekend. I'm sure there are still individual ISIS soldiers floating around in Mosul or close to it. And certainly there are stay-behind people and essentially folks who are going to do terrorist things. But all in all, Mosul has been liberated.
Islamic State still controls wide areas of Iraq, does it not?
No. It controls two cities, Khalifah in Hawija, that are relatively small, and it has the ability to, send out columns and other things. We've seen that in Kirkuk and elsewhere. That is, it still is a terrorist and it is an insurgent organization. It has some power, but other than these two cities, its hold on the population and its hold as a military and state and political entity is over in Iraq.
What happens now to Mosul? Of course, it's devastated. Thousands have been killed.
Well, the first thing is, yeah, you have a relief effort. Tony Blinken wrote about that in the New York Times today, and he's following that closely and set it up before he left government. There's 68 countries in the coalition. They have worked through the UN to provide initial relief and recovery efforts. That won't rebuild the city. That's a job for years and tens of millions of dollars, but it will get the people under some kind of cover. So that's the first step. The second step is, of course, political, as always in Iraq. How are you going to prevent a return of ISIS or something like it, and how are you going to incorporate the Sunni Arabs into the larger Iraq and keep the Kurds, who are in it but quite separate, playing a positive role? Those are the big issues that we've been working with since 2003. They haven't gone away.
What happens now to the future of Islamic State? Do they switch back to terrorism and insurgency?
I think in various places, ungoverned territories, they will find a home. Somalia, the Sinai, they have a strong presence. They have an alliance with Boko Haram in West Africa. And so through social media and the support they get from a tiny, but in terms of numbers, not insignificant number of people in the Middle East, they'll bubble on as a alternative Sunni extremist terrorist movement alongside al-Qaeda.
What about the future of Iraq?
Well, the future of Iraq is at two levels. The first level is the internal reconstruction and the internal reconciliation, a long-term project that we've been working on since 2003 that basically looks to restore it to essentially pre-Saddam in 1979. The second thing is, and it's more important because what determines whether we're successful or not, is the role of Iran in Iraq. Iran is on the march throughout the region, despite the Riyadh summit. The Iranians are getting conflicting signals from the U.S. in Syria, at least. And the Saudis, who were leading the anti-Iranian coalition, basically took a right turn and started putting all their effort into Qatar. So the anti-Iranian effort isn't doing so well.
James Jeffrey is a former senior American diplomat and a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. A Russia-U.S. brokered ceasefire in southwestern Syria continues to hold at this hour. It is the first peacemaking effort in the Syrian civil war led by the U.S. government under President Trump. VOA asked Trinity University Middle East scholar David Lesh if this is a diplomatic breakthrough for Moscow and Washington.
I would not consider it a diplomatic breakthrough. It's encouraging if it's followed up with workable details and an agreement that actually works and maybe something that is transferred to other parts of the country. It seems to me that Putin and Trump in their meeting in Europe were eager to show something out of the meeting, and this seems to be it. And it's relatively easy to agree on de-escalation in parts of Syria that do not have to do with the Islamic State. That's something that both the United States and Russia are keen to do. So the devil, as in most things, the devil will be in the details, and who will be monitoring and who will be enforcing and how long, you know, will the ceasefire be in place and actually work. But it is an area where something like this is a little bit more workable along the Jordanian border. Israel is not officially, but unofficially involved in this. And things have been getting a little bit testy in that part of Syria and southern and southeastern Syria, particularly along the where the Jordanian, Iraqi, and Syrian borders converge, and where there's a U.S. outpost, and where pro-Syrian regime forces have been moving toward the Iraqi border. And, of course, there have been some incidents between U.S. troops and pro-Syrian forces. So I think, you know, in the long term, this, or in the short term, this could be an attempt to try to dampen down any escalation of what has gone on over the last few weeks there.
We also asked Dr. Lesh why we haven't heard much about that part of Syria.
Because the focus of the United States has been in the north against the Islamic State. And, of course, with the regime retaking of Aleppo last December, which made the headlines, and, of course, the U.S. support for the Syrian Democratic Forces, largely made up of Kurdish forces, which the Turks oppose. You know, that's all the headline-grabbing news and where much of the fighting has taken place. But underneath all of that, appears to be sort of a land grab or a race to control various orders of various territories along the Iraqi border, in particular by pro-regime forces and Iranian-supported forces, to establish what some fear to be a land corridor from Iran through Iraq through Syria to Lebanon and its client Hezbollah in Lebanon. So it's gaining more and more notoriety, so to speak, particularly when U.S. forces clashed with the pro-regime and pro-Iranian forces.
Trinity University's David Lesh also noted as efforts move forward for a peace settlement in Syria, there remains the military addenda, which is daily ongoing challenge for all parties, plus the diplomatic efforts, which are just as much of a challenge. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump said on Twitter he discussed with Russian President Vladimir Putin when they met at the G20 summit over the weekend, forming a cybersecurity unit to guard against election hacking. That got almost immediate response from U.S. lawmakers, with several in Mr. Trump's Republican Party calling it a dumb idea. We ask University of Denver Russia scholar Jonathan Edelman for his thoughts.
I think that it really isn't quite as dumb as it seems, but in politics, first impressions are very important. And the idea that the Russians, who have been penetrating not only our capabilities in cybersecurity, but penetrating our friends and allies in Western Europe, could say this seriously showed that it wasn't really very well thought out. And you can see even by the reaction of the administration. I mean, you look at the Tillerson and Mnuchin people, and they're trying to skate away from this without actually doing that. And then you get to Nikki Haley, who says, no, this is a reasonable idea. So his own administration isn't even safe, not alone, let alone, as you already indicated, the number of leading Republicans as well. So I think, if to put it more positively, if we're going to do and try to get along better with the Republican, with Vladimir Putin, the first thing we need is something that has some enforceable characteristics. And this one just doesn't, because the Russians are the ones who are carrying out most of the cybersecurity penetration of the United States. So I think that this is indicative of what the problem has been with this administration, is that previous administrations have thought too long and too hard and forever about issues. This administration thinks too little and doesn't even get their own people on board beforehand. So we need something in the middle.
Dr. Ailman also noted that he doesn't believe the idea will go very far. And we asked him for his thoughts on the Trump-Putin meeting at the G20 summit in Hamburg.
The problem is, what do we actually know about this meeting is one of the issues. I think it was important, but I think maybe it shouldn't have been done in the glare of the G20 summit, you know, for 2 hours and 20 minutes, that it needed to have been adequately prepared beforehand. And I think I indicated in other interviews that the Russians have a real advantage here. They have, you know, in Sergei Lavrov, a first-rate foreign secretary whom I've met and observed when I've been in Moscow, absolutely brilliant. So there they got Trump over, and I don't mean that facetiously, over the Americans. Secondly, that's over Tillerson, who's adequate, but that leads to the second problem. He doesn't have the kind of advisors, the kind of very knowledgeable people that fill up any Russian room that Sergei Lavrov wants. And we really need that. So I'm hoping that the administration will learn from this, that this is very serious, this is very long run, and some of the things that exist in Washington are useful, for example, having a number of advisors who can tell you exactly what these deals are going to mean.
Jonathan Adelman is a professor at the University of Denver, and he specializes in Russia. One of the big events of the G20 summit in Germany was that meeting between President Trump and President Putin. It was described as cordial and a warm get-together. Putin and other Russian officials affirmed their opinion that President Trump believed Putin when he said Moscow did not meddle in U.S. elections. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov speaking here through an interpreter.
President Trump said that he heard firm assertions from President Putin that it is not true and that Russian authorities have not meddled in these elections, and that he said that he accepts these assertions. That's it.
We turn now to VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, who describes to VOA's Jim Stevenson what might come next in the controversy over possible Russian meddling in last year's U.S. presidential election.
This topic is not going anywhere, and it does serve as a distraction while other things are moving forward. The Republicans very much want to repeal and replace Obamacare. Congress is coming back into session this week after a week-long recess. The Republican Senate health care plan is going nowhere, and there is no indication of any movement on that. Republicans number only 52 in the 100-member Senate, and they can only afford to lose 2 votes on this bill. And right now, they simply don't have the votes. And Republicans are counting on accruing some sort of budgetary savings in their health care plan that can then be applied towards tax reform. And in a sense, health reform is the linchpin for other things that they want to do. But here we are in July. There's an August recess coming up. Healthcare reform has yet to be accomplished. Tax reform hasn't been done. The government hasn't been funded for the next year. The debt ceiling hasn't been raised. Jim, this is a long list of things that need attention, either by virtue of the fact that the government won't stay open or the U.S. risks default or the Republican agenda is at risk. This is a long to-do list and very little time to do it.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman. Michael, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
And many thanks to you, gentlemen. Jailed Venezuelan opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez has been released from prison. He's been transferred to house arrest there for health reasons. He was detained back in 2014 for allegedly inciting violence during anti-government protests in which three people died, many more wounded. Meantime, more people have been injured when armed supporters of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stormed the National Assembly building. VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Juan Carlos Hidalgo, Latin American Policy Analyst at the Cato Institute. Farnsworth summarizes the current situation in Venezuela.
Well, the current situation is, I think, deteriorating by the day. There is a deadline of sorts at the end of July, July 30th, which is the date by which the Maduro government has called for a constituent assembly to rewrite the constitution. And that has added some urgency to the opposition, which is trying to derail that particular exercise as being itself unconstitutional and certainly not supported by the majority of the Venezuelan people. And so you're seeing some increasing political maneuvering from both sides. Meanwhile, the street protests that began in late March have increased almost to a daily basis, not just in Caracas, where much of the news comes from, but across the country. And as you indicated in the introduction, the death toll is going up from the regime forces that are killing protesters. So it's a situation that has the potential to turn into a humanitarian crisis. Indeed, you're seeing thousands of Venezuelans crossing the border on a daily basis into Colombia, into Brazil, into the Caribbean as a means to try to feed their families, find medicine that's unavailable in Venezuela, and get away from the deteriorating security situation. So it's a pretty bad scenario right now. And from my perspective, it seems to be getting worse.
Let me turn to you, Juan Carlos Hidalgo, for your perspective on the current crisis, this political crisis, economic crisis in Venezuela, particularly as we run up to the so-called Constituent Assembly on July 30th, which many do see as a violation of the current constitution.
Indeed. Right now, I think Venezuela is facing the last battle for its democracy. If the clock is ticking, if the Constituent Assembly is successfully installed, it will have the power to remove the National Assembly. It will have the power to remove all other institutions, because the Constituent Assembly will have supra-constitutional powers. So once the Constituent Assembly is installed, it will have the power to remove judges. It will have the power to remove the attorney general, who has been attorney the side of the regime lately. He will have the power to call off the regional elections for December, which are scheduled to take place in December. He will have the power to call off the next presidential election. So it will be basically the end of Venezuela's democracy. So, and I think that Venezuelans know this, and this is why they have taken the streets. Unfortunately, we don't see any cracks in the regime. Despite some defections, by the most important figure being the Attorney General, we see that the armed forces are completely behind the regime. Of course, we don't know exactly the circumstances, but at least the rank and file of the armed forces continue to support Maduro. And as long as they are firmly behind the regime, it's going to be very difficult for the protesters to make a difference. Let's remember that when people talk about the possibility of a civil war in Venezuela, we have to keep in mind that only one side has the guns. The other side, being the people, are in the streets with rocks, with sticks, shields, but that's pretty much it. And it's a war of attrition. We are talking about 70 to over 100 people killed in the last 2 to 3 months of protests. And the question is if we will reach a point where people are simply going to fed up, realize that they're not making much of a difference and that the regime is moving ahead to consolidate communist socialist dictatorship.
Juan Carlos Hidalgo is at the Cato Institute. He and Eric Farnsworth of the Council of the Americas and the America Society were speaking with Carol Castiel. She is the host of the VOA program Encounter. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests that our Milky Way galaxy could be home to between 25 and 100 billion brown dwarfs. A brown dwarf is a celestial object with a mass somewhere between a star and a planet. A brown dwarf was supposed to become a star, but sometime during its formation was unable to gain enough mass that it could sustain the needed hydrogen fusion at its core to actually become a full-fledged star. The researchers focused their search within several dense star clusters, which are groups of stars that are gravitationally bound to each other. They found 5 brown dwarfs for every 10 stars in one of the clusters. To see if this was an unusual proportion, they checked another, more distant cluster and found the same ratio of brown dwarfs to stars. The researchers presented their findings at the recently concluded National Astronomy Meeting in the UK. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department today, the story of a remarkable singer. Cassidy was an American singer who died in obscurity in 1996 in the prime of her life. She performed in small clubs around Washington, D.C., and supported her music by selling her locally produced CDs. She was recently remembered at a Washington Folklife Festival. From coast to coast. Faith is the key. Open the doors and Eva Cassidy was not your typical performer. She was very shy and never dressed the part. She virtually was a singer of all genres of music, pop, blues, jazz, gospel. She sang whatever touched her heart. She never knew fame, but in death became a huge success. Her version of Judy Garland's Over the Rainbow from the movie Wizard of Oz became a big hit all over the world.
Somewhere over the rainbow way, up high in the that I heard up once in a lullaby. You dare to dream, really do come true.
When Eva Cassidy died at age 33, she was unheard of, her music virtually unknown. Almost 2 years after her death, Over the Rainbow moved her from obscurity to instant fame when a BBC producer was given one of her CDs. Paul Walter says he was blown away by the beauty of her voice and put it on the air right away at BBC Two. CD sales surged worldwide.
Like lemon drops, away above the chimney tops, that's away.
In the spring of 1996, Eva Cassidy started walking with a cane because of unrelenting pain in her hip. The cause, cancer. She was given only a few months to live. Eva's friends organized a benefit for her, and she rose from the pain to sing that night. It was her last public performance. She sang, What a wonderful world.
I see trees that are green, red roses too. I watch them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I hear babies cry, watch them grow, and they'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, oh, what a wonderful world.
Yeah, I think the BBC's Paul Walters is right. Beautiful voice. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington and hoping you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Eva Cassidy.
Also on the faces of the people passing by, I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? But they're really saying, I love you.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The struggle we face here in Afghanistan is as old as human history, said U.S. Chargé d'Affaires to Afghanistan Hugo Lawrence. It is a fight between those forces that empower and liberate people against those who physically and spiritually subjugate their fellow human beings. Speaking in Kabul at a Resolute Support commemoration ceremony for the victims of the May 31st attack in Kabul, Ambassador Lawrence noted the struggle in this heroic land is a fight between the vast majority of Afghans who simply want to rebuild their country and create a better life for their sons and daughters against a small group of people who are filled with hate and know only the path of violence and destruction. In the deadliest terrorist attack to take place in Kabul to date, a truck bomb exploded near the German embassy on May 31st, killing over 150 and injuring 413, mostly civilians, and damaging several buildings in the embassy. The terrorists responsible for the horrific attack account it a great victory. How wrong they are, said Ambassador Lawrence. Let me say I have no doubt that the forces of light, faith, and love will prevail, bring peace and honor to these brave and proud men. And those thousands of brave young Americans, Afghans, and of the other allied nations who have fallen in this cause. The vast majority of Afghans are builders on the side of progress, he said. Each and every day we see the progress Afghans have made in such little time since 2001. The schools, the hospitals, the government buildings and centers of commerce, cell phones and public services, all accomplished in the past 16 years. They are physical manifestations of the will of a people who build and believe in peace for themselves and others. By contrast, he said, there exists only a very small minority who are destroyers, those who seek to tear down, it seems, for hateful and evil reasons. But the arc of history is clear. These destroyers cannot prevail because their ideology is self-destructive, and they will either lay down their arms or meet their end. Afghanistan is not alone in this fight, he said. The United States pledges to see this through to the end and to honor our commitments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.